WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV with your host, Rebecca Terrell. This broadcast is committed to helping you understand the truth behind the news. And now, here's your host, Rebecca Terrell.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. Today is Monday, February 13th. Here are some of the headlines we're following. On February 6th, following a train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, emergency officials set several overturned cars ablaze. They'd been transporting vinyl chloride, and the intentional fire was a controlled release of the hazardous chemical. The massive burn caused a dense mushroom cloud to darken the Ohio skies. Residents are accusing the media and government of conducting a cover-up, as reporting on the disaster has been minimal. Evan Lambert of News Nation was arrested as he attempted to cover the crisis.
Stop this.
Authorities in East Palestine are claiming it is safe to return to the area, but residents are complaining of sickened animals and a strong odor, indicating an ongoing risk. A TikToker has been studying the situation and documenting his findings on the social media platform.
This hasn't been getting a lot of coverage, and the coverage that it has been getting hasn't been very good. So let's talk about the train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio. Of the cars that crashed, five of them contained vinyl chloride. It's a monomer used to make PVCs. So vinyl chloride is really toxic. OSHA has the permissible limit of how much you can be exposed to it during an 8-hour shift as a 1 ppm part per million. Average over 8 hours. There's maybe 1 million pounds of this toxic chemical spilling into the ground and also boiling off into the air. But then it caught on fire. I think this is where the reporting is really bad, because no one is mentioning what the byproduct of vinyl chloride burning is. Of the many byproducts of burning vinyl chloride, one of them is hydrogen chloride. Hydrogen chloride is really unstable and latches onto water, like just water vapor in the atmosphere, and that turns into hydrochloric acid. So right now, government officials, officials from the railroad, both the governor of Pennsylvania and Ohio are calling burning off the 1 million pounds of this stuff a success, but not mentioning that it means that we have hundreds of thousands of pounds of acid in the air.
In international news, Russia may be considering changing its stance on nuclear first strike capability, just as the New York Times is the mouthpiece for the State Department and the Washington Post is the organ used by the CIA to publicize talking points. So the Russian network Pravda is used to disseminate information to the public. On that network, former Army commander and current member of parliament, Andrei Gurilov, said that due to NATO troops amassing on the Russian border, the law might be altered to change nuclear first use protocols. He opted for allowing for a nuclear first strike before a war was officially declared.
Бояться того, чего не надо бояться. Нам надо побеждать. Вот и все на этом. Надо к этому идти. Теми способами, тем оружием, которое у нас есть. Я помню, что тоже ядерное оружие, это не просто какая-то бомба лежащая. Это достояние всего российского народа, выстраданное в самые тяжелые времена. Именно российского. Это наше достояние. И мы имеем право его применять для защиты нашей Родины. Доктрину поменять. Это, наверное, бумагу написать. А вот решение принять, вот это, наверное, стоит.
And if you think it's just the Russians considering these things, it's not. In the face of recent NATO setbacks, neocon Michael Rubin has called for nuclear weapons to be placed in the Ukraine as a deterrent to Russia. As events unfold, tensions are ramping up. In what may or may not be related news, airspace over north central Montana has purportedly been closed down. This was the same area that recently saw the putatively Chinese spy balloon hovering over Malmstrom Air Force Base and monitoring nuclear facilities. Officially, America has about 400 active nuclear missile silos in Montana, Wyoming, and North Dakota. Is the United States now on increased alert due to changes in Russian first strike policy? Here to discuss more is The New American's commentator, Daniel Natale. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rebecca. This is, before we start off, everything has to be taken with a huge grain of salt. Like, for instance, in that clip, if the viewers would notice, there was a Ukrainian flag for the person doing the subtitles. So, you know, bear that in mind, give that like a huge grain of salt. If it is a legitimate translation, it appears to be actually, take another huge grain of salt, because we have to remember that one of the Jenga pieces that the West is dealing with right now is if Putin is removed, there's a lot of hardliners there to replace him. And so we think of Putin as like a hardliner. Actually, he's a moderate. If he's removed, then people like Guruliev is, you know, may replace him. And they're very belligerent. And they're making points like when the United States used, you know, nuclear weapons or atomic weapons at the time in World War II, that, you know, it was a lot less dire of a situation. Like the Japanese had not, you know, breached the United States's territory at the time. You know, Hawaii was not a state at the time. You know, they had not gone to the 48 contiguous states in 19, you know, at the time of World War I, 1941. And he was like saying, you know, how would the United States have used nuclear deterrence if the Japanese were off the coast of Washington, D.C., say? And so he's a lot of their kind of crazies are making the point that they would be justified in possibly using nuclear weapons as NATO is amassing on their border. So it's getting to be a very tricky situation.
Yes, it is. And it's they didn't, of course, back in the time of the World Wars, they didn't have technology as sophisticated as Chinese spy balloons, right?
Well, I mean, that we don't really know the truth of anything that's going on. Right. I mean, not only are we shutting down airspace over Montana, but then there's subsequent reports of shutting down airspace over Michigan and a bunch of other, you know, possible nuclear facilities. So this may be, you know, a lot more dire than what the public is currently being told right now. For instance, the State Department just issued a warning, a travel advisory to keep Americans out of Russia. You know, just strange things are happening, you know, like behind the scenes that suggest that, you know, things may be getting a little out of hand. For instance, Michael Rubin, you know, as you know, related in that that write up, he was under the Bush Department. He was a neocon, and Reagan had banished the neocons for 20 years. He called them the crazies because even back in the 80s, they wanted to launch a nuclear war against the Soviet Union. And right. And now the neocons are back in power. Michael Rubin is basically the counterpart of Guraliev. Like, you know, he wants to put nukes in the Ukraine. Guraliev wants to respond in like kind. So we're seeing, you know, something ramp up, and it might be comparable to the Spanish Civil War prior to World War II, where all of a sudden you saw these tensions rise. And so what Ukraine is to Russia, Taiwan is to China, and you're seeing, like, I mean, just very, you know, unstable people making very reckless proposals. And, you know, right now we don't know what's going on. So
exactly. We very much don't know. And moving on in our headlines, speaking of that, the Chinese spy balloon, which was shot down earlier this month over the coast of South Carolina, has certainly captured the nation's attention. But since then, three other crafts have been shot down over North America. Chuck Schumer called them weather balloons, but other commentators have provided different descriptions.
The U.S. defense officials sent F-35 fighter jets up to try to figure out what this object was that was flying around near Alaska. Those pilots, we have learned, have given very conflicting accounts of what they actually experienced, with some pilots saying that the object interfered with the plane's sensors, other pilots saying that they didn't really experience that, other pilots saying that when they looked at the object, they could identify no identifiable propulsion system, and they did not know how it was actually staying in the air.
Most recently, on Sunday, the military brought down another object over Lake Huron. They described it as octagon-shaped and flying at 20,000 feet. Was this another spy balloon or something else? Now, if you're a Kansas City Chiefs fan, you're happy today because your team won last night's Super Bowl. If you're a true blue American, you might not be so happy with the fact that the NFL used the annual sports event as a platform for or woke leftist propaganda. For the first time, the Black National Anthem was sung before the game. This made news abroad, even with the Australian press checking in to declare that they found it a bit odd.
The NFL seems determined to jam race politics down the throats of its audience. It's now playing a Black National Anthem as well. I mean, I thought a national anthem was for the whole population. Obviously, I was wrong.
Lift every voice I see.
This is in addition to an end racism message printed on the end zone and the NFL's first all-female air show. Why is the NFL pushing this agenda? And what's the end game here? The presence of confidential informants during the January 6th protest is now common knowledge, but it appears that these tactics may be more widespread than we thought. The Intercept last week published a piece about an individual named Michael Windecker. The FBI used this individual, whose criminal background is extensive, to infiltrate left-wing groups in Denver. The Bureau reportedly paid him $20,000 in the summer of 2020. And he allegedly worked with the FBI and BLM groups. Activists who spoke to The Intercept ID'd Windecker as a key orchestrator of a week of riots that took place in Denver in August of 2020. That event left 70 police officers injured. In the 1970s, the FBI launched COINTELPRO, a secret project designed to infiltrate and control radical political organizations with the help of FBI agents and paid informants. Projects like COINTELPRO appear to be ongoing. Are they designed to catch radicals or engineer mayhem? Real Clear Investigations has recently taken a close look at the Amalgamated Bank, an obscure organization with outsized influence.
The values that Amalgamated Bank is organized around really come from our founding 100 years ago, but are very much still at the center of everything that we do. So racial, social, economic, and sustainable justice, right? These are the things that are present in all of the products, in our approach to the work that we do as an institution and the communities that we serve.
Boasting of its status as the oldest ESG bank in the country, it has also worked to control gun sales by creating a credit card code used to identify gun sales, enabling gun owners to be further tracked and monitored. This comes as outspoken political activists like Brandon Straka of the Walkaway Movement have increasingly found themselves debanked.
Every J6er that I'm aware of has been permanently banned by PayPal, Venmo, Stripe, Patreon. People have been debanked. And just as recently as yesterday, I received a notification from a company. I'm working with a wonderful company from Delaware called Metro Payment Technologies that's actually helping people who are being deplatformed. They're a payment processing company. They're amazing. But they were trying to help me set up a new account with a banking institution. And we've received a letter back yesterday on my application in which the banking institution said, unfortunately, we are going to have to decline based on the owner's involvement and subsequent conviction surrounding the January 6th Capitol riot.
Is social control via the financial sector the face of tyranny to come, Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. You have the story, you started off with the story of the Super Bowl and kind of like the propaganda, the racial propaganda, the female flyers, the woke thing, the Black National Anthem. And then you ended with the banks being used to promote ESG and to use social control mechanisms. And they're related. Both of those stories are related. Just to start off with the Black National Anthem, I just wanted to make a really quick point on that. Remember when Jimi Hendrix did the Star Spangled Banner in 1969? That was like a call to inclusion. Right. And now they have the Black National Anthem, which is basically the Jim Crow. It's the separate but equal anthem. And so this is bizarre, but this is part and parcel of what they're doing through ESG is they're basically radicalizing the population. They're collapsing the nation state social cohesion. They have to divide and conquer. They have to divide and conquer different demographics. And so Larry Fink, during the last financial collapse, let's start it there. In 2008, we had a financial collapse. All these businesses were insolvent. Larry Fink, who runs BlackRock, which has $13 trillion under management, was tapped by the Treasury to give out bailout packages. And he said, I'll bail out your company if you do these woke things, if you do ESG, right? So that's why the Football League is doing this, because they want money from Goldman Sachs. They want money from different investment banks, Deutsche Bank, Bank of America. And they'll be able to get those lines of credit if they do the woke messaging. Likewise, with the banking thing at the very end with Brandon Straka and debanking people from January 6th, it's the same ESG protocols that have been handed out by Larry Fink. So those stories are actually very, very much connected to each other.
Right. And it's such a lie to say that it's actually racism. What we're talking about here has nothing to do with race. It has to do with culture. And that's what they're trying to, we have to embrace, not just accept, but embrace a culture that's based on the hip hop and rap and that kind of, I mean, I'm using entertainment indicators to describe it, but it involves the entire social culture that we have in this country, you know, the family being the most important unit, and our God, our religion, they're after it. And that's what we're going to have to give up if we want to adhere to all of this woke propaganda and the agenda that they have going for us. Daniel, we are out of time. I regret that, because this is an interesting conversation, but we'll see you back tomorrow, and we will see everybody else back on the other side of this break.
If Americans want to remain a free and sovereign nation, more people need to understand the principles and values that built this great nation. At the John Birch Society, we have the organization, the plan, and the resources to do just that. Our founder, Robert Welch, said, "Education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon." Go to jbs.org to learn more, including how you can get involved to work locally and impact nationally. Join the John Birch Society today.
Here's the news, Dad.
Is it, son? Is it?
What about this one, Dad?
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
The truth is hard to find, but the New American has it. Check it out at thenewamerican.com.
All right, parents, listen up. We've all seen the countless examples of how radical leftists have been destroying American schools. It's no longer just about the terrible math and reading levels. Now radical left teachers birthed from liberal universities are forcing gender indoctrination in kindergarten. They're teaching lessons on white guilt.
Freedom Project Academy has perfected live online learning over the course of a decade. I get a ton of great feedback about this program, a ton.
They're built on Judeo-Christian values, a classical curriculum. What does that mean? It means they're taught, your children are taught the way that the founding generations of the country. My own son Noah did Freedom Project Academy for several years when he was younger.
The more we tell our friends about these things, the more people will get on board, and I believe that we can be the catalyst to some real change.
We must save the West. Our way of life and our culture is under attack, and because of patriots like you and your project, I have optimism for the future.
Welcome back to the New American TV, where we report the truth behind the news. Clinical trials for mRNA vaccines in humans have made headlines for well more than a year, but similar trials in livestock, wildlife, and pets are now getting attention. The New American's Veronica Kirilenko recently met with mRNA platform pioneer Dr. Robert Malone, who outlined the issues with federal regulations concerning vaccines for animals, and he weighed the risks too. Let's take a look.
Dr. Malone, welcome. It's so great to see you again.
Veronica, thank you again for having me. I don't know, is this interview number 5 or 6?
Who's counting?
It's always a pleasure. And often our interviews are at the very forefront of hot topics that later get validated and go mainstream. So good on you for actually being a journalist.
Oh, thank you.
I know it's a rare breed, but I think. Between the two of us, we might have made an impact in a good way together with the New American, and I'm grateful for the support of the New American.
I really hope so, Doctor, and thank you for being a real scientist and a truth teller. It's a rare quality today, unfortunately. Doctor, so last week you published a Substack post titled "mRNA Vaccines in Livestock and Companion Animals Are Here Now. So as I understand, your main concern is that it is extremely difficult to track clinical trials for new vaccines, drugs, and biologics in animals. Would you please elaborate on that?
Well, that's certainly one aspect, and that was something that was highlighted in the essay, in the Substack essay. And by the way, that I just want to give credit where credit's due. Dr. Jill Glaspell Malone did the due diligence on that. She did the research behind it, and she wrote much of it. I edited and added some additional stuff, but this is very much a team effort between Jill and I. The genesis of this essay was that many weeks ago, I was on a podcast interview, and I mentioned casually that mRNA vaccines are being deployed in zoos and in companion animals, etc. And this was clipped out and circulated, I think it was on Instagram, as a little short meme. And suddenly I was getting calls from all over the world about this, and reporters, particularly from the livestock industry, inquiring. And so we decided that we really needed to back up that short sentence with the actual receipts, the documents. So Jill did a deep dive into this. And the unfortunate truth is, as you're pointing out, that consequent to the AIDS events in the early 80s, there was a push to make information about human clinical trials open and transparent. And that led to the website clinicaltrials.gov, among other things, and changes in federal law about transparency in human clinical research. So now we're all able to find what trials are being enrolled and who's doing them and what the criteria are and who the principal investigator, all that key information we can now easily discover on clinicaltrials.gov. There's nothing akin to that for the USDA. The USDA has the responsibility to regulate animal research and animal vaccines. So that's a lot harder to dig that out. And in some ways, it's a little less transparent and reliable than somebody, you know, officially posting, because they're required, exactly what the nature of the trial is that they're doing, how large the sample sizes are, what the control groups. Instead, you get this kind of pre-digested spin that comes from the pharmaceutical industry that we've all become familiar with. They're very skilled at, you know, in the ways of crafting language to make everything look as good as possible. But what Jill was able to uncover is that, in fact, animal research on the use of mRNA vaccines has been ongoing now for quite a long time, since about 2015 at least. That's what she can trace. That the USDA has used something akin to their version of emergency use authorization to authorize Merck to produce and distribute a porcine vaccine. So this is for a pig virus intended to protect the pork industry here in the United States. And those were deployed. We first heard about this, and this is an unconfirmed rumor, consider it that, but a report from a pig farmer that federal officials showed up at his farm and told him that he will administer this mRNA vaccine to his pigs. He didn't have any choice. So that's that kind of thing that doesn't make headlines. They, you know, it's not in the general public consciousness. And it appears that also there certainly were multiple press accounts of the zoo industry in the midst of all the fear porn. And by the way, I recommend there's a new summary of the fear porn that was pushed in the media about our children and our children's risk of COVID-19 that's well worth watching. And it was covered by Matt Taibbi in his Substack today. So that's something to look for. But we all know that we were subjected to this massive amount of propaganda. This is nothing new to your audience and to the New American. You'll recall that there was also back then a lot of fear porn around the fact that domestic cats might get infected and that the deer population was infected and that zoo animals were going to die from this. And it just went on and on and on. And so zookeepers, as they often do, reacted by seeking vaccines for their livestock, which included, as I recall, the COVID-19 vaccines, although it's very difficult to document that now. And we did have all this discussion about that we might have to either get rid of all the cats, all the domestic cats, or you could imagine what that's going to do on social media. I can't even begin to imagine what Gatto
Mall. Isn't it what they do in China?
Exactly. Then there's this deeper issue about the use of this technology to enable rapid response capabilities for animal health. And there is a bona fide need. Often outbreaks of viruses, novel influenza viruses, other viruses, are often handled in veterinary medicine and in agriculture by what's called culling the herd. Obviously, that's something that is unethical in the case of humans, although there's an active discussion about whether or not that has actually been going on in the current COVID-19 case, but let's park that for now. Whether Klaus Schwab is culling the herd or not, that's pure speculation right now, and we're not going to go there. But in terms of veterinary practice, that has long been the case. If a chicken house gets a novel virus, all the chickens in that chicken house and the surrounding ones will often be slaughtered and put into burn pits and covered up as just a standard public health practice. In some Scandinavian nations, I think the Netherlands, this is the case, they often don't vaccinate against things that affect livestock because they would prefer, and this is, by the way, the virology and immunology culture that Gert van den Bosch grew up in. So it helps understand Gert to know that in the veterinary practice world that he comes from, it's considered the best option to, rather than inject livestock, you know, feed animals with vaccine products that might make it more difficult to see if an infection does start, a novel infection. Instead, the practice is to not vaccinate, then the disease becomes apparent very quickly. And then you just cull that herd or flock. And that way the virus never has an opportunity to evolve. That's that logic, for better or worse. And so here in the United States and in China, we don't take that logic. That's not our practice. The practice here in the United States is every livestock animal's life is sacred up until the point they're slaughtered, because they represent profit. I'm being a little facetious, but you'll appreciate the logic here. And so one of the things about the livestock industry is in the United States with these factory farming practices with chickens and swine in particular, but also cattle, is the margins are very, very tight. It's highly competitive. There's a lot of imported meat that's brought into the United States, for instance, from China. And they have the meat processors have enacted legislation and executive actions that have made it so that when they bring in, for instance, a carcass of a cow, let's say from Argentina, just to take a name. So there's a lot of beef production in Latin America, obviously. And they bring in a carcass. As soon as a butcher touches that carcass with a knife, under current policy, USDA policy, that carcass is now considered to be of American manufacture, and it can be labeled as American beef. Yeah. To know. Okay, so that's the world we're in. And, you know, we've let ourselves be managed in this way because we haven't paid attention to what's been going on at USDA and with our politicians. But that's the reality. And the consequence, of course, is that for the independent farmer, rancher, that's trying to produce a high quality meat product here in the United States, they're under extreme financial pressure. And as a derivative of this, they have to, if they're going to use vaccines and their margins are tight, they have no option other than to use very inexpensive vaccines that can be easily deployed. And so what Merck has developed with their mRNA vaccine platform is a bulk jet injection system where the material sits in a cup, and you can see in the Substack article a link to this. The vaccine material sits in a cup, and then it sits on top of a jet injector that's powered by air or CO2. And then the the veterinarian or the animal technician can go to animal after animal after animal and just pull a trigger and it squirts the vaccine into the skin. This used to be the way that people were vaccinated back in the early smallpox days for a period of time when we had these mass campaigns, say in New York City, where we had to process so many people. But the problem in humans is that when you use jet injection, you often get a little bit of body fluid blow back onto the injector. And if a person A happens to have hepatitis B or hepatitis C, and then you move on to person C and do the injection, suddenly you're also injecting them with a little bit of hepatitis C and they get sick. But that's what happened with the jet injection business in humans, is it's absolutely the best way to do it rapidly and economically, but it's absolutely not safe because of this cross-contamination problem. But apparently in swine herds, with the Merck system, they can just go along pig to pig to pig to pig and do the injections. So that's out there. Merck has this platform. It's mRNA based. They have been granted the USDA equivalent of emergency use authorization.
But is there an emergency, sir?
There was, apparently, according to USDA, with a pig virus. And so that's already been deployed. And whoever, you know, that has, people have eaten that pork without ever knowing it. That's all in the past and will be again in the future, whenever they believe that they have a sufficient viral threat. Pfizer's animal health arm is called Zoetis, and it's massive.
Pfizer developing these vaccines again.
Right. So Pfizer is not disclosing anything about what they're doing in mRNA vaccine development for animal health. So we know nothing about that. So there are other smaller companies that have done deals with that, smaller companies that are advancing this technology that have done deals with some of the larger animal health manufacturers. And so that's covered in the Substack to the extent that we could find anything. I think what we can conclude is that once again, this technology is being deployed into certainly animals intended for human consumption. And little, if anything, has been done. Certainly almost nothing has been published, if anything, about potential risks of material transfer from the animals to the humans. I don't think that's going to be a huge risk, but I didn't think that there was going to be a risk of these vaccine products being secreted in breast milk, and I was wrong. The data are the data, and we have to follow the data. So in the case of animal health, I'm not aware that the studies have been done to teach us and demonstrate to the public that animals that have been inoculated with these materials are not going to transfer that material into humans in some way or cause other unintended effects in humans or others that might consume those animal products. And I think that once again, the federal government is not being open and transparent with us. And I believe after their track record of the last 3 years, all of us, but particularly those concerned for personal sovereignty, and you know, the typical new American audience should insist that the federal government be more proactive in doing these studies and disclosing the results to the American public, rather than allowing this material to enter our supermarkets without us even being aware. And I think one of the derivatives of this is going to be more and more people turning to the small producer, the small US-based producer. It means you're gonna have to pay more for your beef. You're gonna have to work a little harder to find chicken that has been raised properly and slaughtered properly by farmers who respect quality and safety and purity of the material. And for many people that are on the on the edge, they're not going to be able to afford that, unfortunately. But I advocate, just as I advocate for homeschooling, I advocate that people, if they have the option, if they have the time, if they have the finances, seek out those small producers and insist on openness and transparency in terms of our feed, the material that we're taking into our bodies. I think we have a right to it, to insist on that. And personally, while you're at it, I advocate that you speak to your congresspeople or whomever and tell them that it's not okay that we're having imported meat come into our country under these terms and conditions, that all they have to do is put a knife on it and then it's declared a U.S. product. That's false. We have the right to know if our material, if our meat, if our food is coming from China or Argentina or Israel or wherever it's coming from. I think that it needs to be properly labeled. And for those things that people want to buy USA, they can't really buy USA when the USDA is busy trying to obscure the true provenance of those products.
Agreed. Dr. Robert Malone, thank you so much for your time today, sir. Would you please tell us what's the best way to follow you and your work and where to find your latest book, Lies My Government Sold Me?
The book is available in all booksellers. That's Lies My Government Told Me and The Better Future Coming. The Better Future requires the audience of the New American to stand with us and be fellow warriors to build that better future for our children. Then, so it's available as ebook or paper in Amazon, Barnes and Noble, pretty much all booksellers now. It's turning into a bestseller. It's not number one. It's not as big as Bobby Kennedy's book, but it's doing okay. And then, of course, rwmalonemd.substack.com. And Twitter, amazingly, since our last discussion, turned on the switch, and I've gone from a little under 450,000 followers to, I'm just checking right now, 923,600 wow. followers. So we're all across Twitter, where it's at RW Malone MD, Getter, also at RW Malone MD. Look for the checks. There are false accounts. And also on Gab and Truth Social. I look forward to learning from the posts of people that follow and comment on the Substack and on social media, and particularly from my friends at the New American.
Well, Veronica Karolinko has been covering a lot of COVID information. I think you'll agree that interview she conducted with Dr. Malone was very important. We encourage you to visit thenewamerican.com and look her up, her articles, and all of her interviews, and we will see you after these messages.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Declaration of Independence proclaims God-given rights, and we intend to protect them. Working with people like you for over 50 years, preserving freedom and building a better tomorrow. Safeguarding the Constitution by limiting government power. We are restoring liberties, educating voters, and leading the freedom movement. Join with us. United, we will defend our rights. We are all Americans. We are the John Birch Society.
Sophia paused before the door. It read, Department of Bi-Digital Convergence. Just inside was a new world, a better world, the one of everlasting life, of no pain, of no loss, of no problem. She entered the chamber and her surroundings changed. She saw around her an infinite field of waving golden grain surmounted by cloudless blue sky. The AI voice whispered gently in her mind, Welcome to the Singularity. She couldn't see it and couldn't feel it, but her body had almost instantly been covered by a swarm of tiny gray multi-legged bots that melted through her clothes and into her skin. Not perceiving the nightmare, Her eyes had already been consumed and the rest of her body was dissolving as the bots digested her flesh. She felt only a warmth suffusing her being. Drowsy, she drifted to sleep, and her last thought was one of panic. Would she ever wake? Could a nightmare vision like this be an outcome of the much-hyped transhumanist technological singularity? Enter the world of the future as illuminated by the experience of the past in Endgame, the new book by Dennis Barrett, the publisher of The New American Magazine, and find out how the disastrous COVID pandemic response fits with the technocratic elite's thirst to create a transhumanist utopia. Get Endgame from shopjbs.org with free shipping with code ENDSHIP, ENDSHIP. Or get Endgame and the Great Reset Collector's issue of The New American Magazine and get free shipping plus an additional 20% off both with code END20, END20.
Welcome back to The New American TV, where we report the truth behind the news. We're having a little bit of an abbreviated final section of the program because Veronica Kirilenko's interview with Dr. Malone was longer, and I think you'll agree it was very important to have that information out. I did want to mention one important legislative, it's very good news, actually, something that's happened in South Dakota. House Bill 1133 has passed the House. It is now in the Senate, and it is going to be debated as soon as the 16th of this month, just later this week. So we're very excited about it because this is the bill that would clarify that products intended for permanent sequestration, such as carbon dioxide, are not commodities under South Dakota law. And by extension, that companies seeking to build carbon capture pipelines cannot use eminent domain to put those in. Right now, those companies are trying to do that in South Carolina, the Dakotas, Iowa, several states in the Midwest Corn Belt. So we encourage you to visit jbs.org/alerts to look up the latest on these bills like this that are trying to protect, seeking to protect individuals' property rights. It's not just an issue that concerns the people in the Midwest. This is an individual fundamental that concerns all of us, anyone who owns private property in the United States. JBS.org/alerts is also the place you can go to find information about the topic we're going to discuss next, which is the Constitutional Convention. And joining me to discuss that is Mr. Paul Dragoo, Communications Director of the John Birch Society. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hi, Rebecca. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Well, it's always a pleasure because you always bring such great information to us. So I think that you have some updates for us as well in the Constitutional Convention arena.
Yeah. By the way, exciting to hear what's happening in South Dakota. You and I have both been following that story and we've written our share of stories. And of course, I've been in touch with our coordinator out of Iowa, where a lot of the fighting is going on. And it sounds like it's going to be heading out to South Dakota. So it's great to see our Birchers and our supporters have been so active in Iowa and South Dakota. And it's no different for the Constitutional Convention battle. I don't know if all your readers know, but a quick summary is that we have been in this battle for since the 1980s, I believe 83 or some thereabouts. And the idea is that it sounds good. The idea, of course, being that the way to rein in out of control government would be to have some more amendments, would be to change the Constitution. Actually, I take that back. It doesn't sound good. That's the problem we have with it, is because they propose to rein in out of control government by changing the Constitution. We argue, and I think it's pretty evident, that that's not, the problem is obviously not the Constitution. It is not being adhered to now. We could do a 3-hour show on all the ways that it is being disobeyed. So what's needed is adherence to the Constitution. So we got folks working really, really hard in states all over where there is a con battle to help educate legislators and inform and the public in general to pressure legislators and to help them see the light, really, to not vote for an application for an Article 5 convention. So one such example is in Montana, where Senate Joint Resolution 2 was recently killed. And the reason that happened is because a lot of Birchers and supporters, they work their tails off. And so I want to show what that's about, because we're always talking about activism, and I don't know that we're always providing great examples, but there's so many. So I wanted to just pick one little example out there out of Montana. So for instance, before the legislative session, in Montana they have a legislative session every other year. And they have it for about 4 months at the beginning of the year. So before the legislative session started, both sides, those for a con and those of us against it, began their work. And so, I'm losing my thought here. So anyway, one of the things that our members did, our Kalispell chapter, for instance, and I got all this information from our coordinator, Alan Lackey, out there in Montana. Our Kalispell chapter, what they did is before the legislative session was about to get started, is they put together 150 packets, snail mail packets, for every legislator, every state legislator, with information including TNA's Article 5 convention issue, a special report, which is awesome, by the way, pamphlets and Slim Jims and all sorts of whatever will help to create understanding among them. And then they sent them all out. They sent them out to those legislators. Now, on the other side, I got to mention, because one of the things that Convention of States, the leading organization that was doing, is they actually got, they kind of got nailed for doing what is considered kind of unethical. And there's a complaint that was filed with the Montana Commission of Political Practices. And what they show is that they dumped $121,000 into three candidates to support a con. So that's kind of how they play. We work to educate. And so that was what the Kalispell chapter did. There is a gentleman out in Ravalli County, more on the central to eastern side of the state, and he apparently literally wore out the shoe leather on his shoes going to stores, to businesses, to the mall, to restaurants, to wherever he could, to help create understanding, to talk to people, to help them understand why it's dangerous to call for a constitutional convention. And then we have members out in Great Falls and throughout the rest of the state, and they emailed and they called their legislators, and they used the .gov website to also use email blasts and to also continue to pressure them. One legislator told our coordinator that he seemed surprised that he heard so much opposition to this. You know, it's kind of, I guess they weren't expecting it or not. But what happened about 2 weeks ago or some thereabouts, Senate joint resolution on its third vote was killed. It was close. It's always close in Montana. It was close the year before, and it was close now. It was a tie. Now we're not completely out of the woods there. There are balanced budget amendments, as well as the term limit amendment that they might bring up. But it's looking good. We started well, and there's a good chance we'll get a victory out in Montana.
That is absolutely fantastic. You know, I'm thinking about this, and I remember back from my old Birch Camp days as a teenager, they've been pushing to uproot our Constitution and replace it for years, for decades.
Yeah.
I remember back then that Teddy Kennedy was involved in writing. They had actually already written a new Constitution. I wish I could get my hands on that. I'd love to read it again, and because it was atrocious. And of course, there's no mention whatsoever of our rights coming from God and government being instituted to protect those rights, not to tell us what to do. It was just the opposite. It was even worse than Canada's current Constitution. But who is behind this current Constitution of the States organization? You mentioned that. Who's funding it? What's the drive behind it?
Well, as I mentioned, the main driver that we're seeing is Convention of States. It is an organization that's led by Mark Meckler. What we know of Convention of States, especially from public documents and such, is first of all, they have a nice treasure chest of money at their disposal. You know, public documents show that for 1 year, I believe 2019, they had upward to $7 million. They have a suave marketing campaign, and so they pull at the heartstrings of Americans in the sense that they go to them and they say, "Are you worried about what's happening in the nation?" And of course, we're all worried. everyone can say, yeah, yeah, we're really worried. Like, how do we fix this? And they're like, we have this semi-silver bullet. You know, I say semi because it's still like you still have to get 34 states to apply. And so they're saying if you pass, if we apply, your state applies, and then we get enough, we can get a convention called, and then we can fix everything. Now, of course, that's not what history shows, and it's not the case. For all that to be fixed, we already have remedies. We already have constitutional remedies. For instance, with term limits, we have elections. Now, it doesn't make any sense. Like, for instance, the same people who voted in Nancy Pelosi, you think they're going to vote in someone different? You know, but then we have a growing crop of constitutional legislators. And on the other hand, we'd hate for those folks to go after 4 years or whatnot, because those are harder to find. But again, we have term limits. They're called elections. And we also have budget amendments. Every state has to keep a budget, I believe every state. And then, of course, why do we keep raising the debt ceiling?
Right? Exactly.
Yeah, it's like we already have that. Who's to say that they're going to adhere to it? But the danger, of course, is that once you open up that Constitution, once for amendments, there's no telling. There's no telling what can happen. The Nation magazine, a very progressive, or I should say leftist, because there's nothing really progressive about it, has actually advocated for a constitutional convention. And they look at it as like, this might be an opportunity to, for instance, put universal health care in the Constitution. Others have looked at it as an opportunity to finally get rid of those pesky Second Amendment rights and all sorts of, you know, it's no secret. There's Wolfpack. That's a leftist organization. They're looking at this as an opportunity. And so it's once we have learned, and I was down in Texas for the Texas GOP convention, and I met lots of people. And what I've saw personally after already hearing about it, we have learned that once both sides, someone hears both sides of this argument, the chances are in our favor. They always, that's why, for instance, Mark Meckler, again, head of COS, he refuses to debate our top constitutional scholar, Robert Brown, who uses his personal time to help create understanding. And I've seen it. I saw the hearing out in Ohio last year where we trounced them. And I mean, they didn't have a chance, because the moment we got folks out there to talk about the dangers of this and also the remedy, those legislators were done. They were not having it. And we crushed it in Ohio, like we did in Iowa, like we did in South Dakota, like we did in Utah, and like we just now won in Montana. The idea, though, is the challenge a lot of the time is to get an equal voice. They spend a lot of resources on radio with big audiences and whatnot, but they don't have the John Birch Society grassroots organization, and that's our main weapon, and it's been working.
Absolutely, it has. It's wonderful. I want you to kind of detail where the battleground states are now that we've had all these wins. But first, can you also explain? I mean, what's the excuse for calling a constitutional convention? We already have in the Constitution the means whereby you can amend the Constitution. So, I mean, right there, that should be a red flag for people to go, if you want to add an amendment, go through the proper process. Why do you have to have a full constitutional convention?
Right. That's a good question. I mean, I don't know. I can't speak for the ulterior motives of others or whatnot, or I can't even say if they're truly genuine. But right. The risks, as one person who testified in Ohio, it seems like there's a lot of risk and very little benefit, if any, to this. He says it doesn't make any sense. And like we said, we already have the remedies. What we need, you know, Glenn Beck was one who advocated for a con for a long time. He was one of his main supporters. And they still, in some places, our National Field Corps, they just sent me a screenshot out in the Georgia Capitol where the COS has an advertisement, and among its long list of supporters is Glenn Beck on there. They didn't take his name off. Glenn Beck is no longer, by the way, a supporter for one of the main reasons that we say. He says it's like we are not at a point in history, in American history, to be trusted to open what he called that sacred document. And what he's referring to, and this is one of our points, is that we have such constitutional ignorance that we are not, we don't need to get near that thing. Thomas Massie said the same thing in a quote. He said, show me a single state where constitutionalists comprise a majority of the state legislature. At this point in history, an Article 5 convention of the states would be a disaster. This, of course, was echoed by former Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. I believe his exact words is, whoa, wouldn't want a constitutional convention now. He's like, who knows what would come out of that? Ron Paul, of course, no slouch when it comes to the Constitution, and someone you may know, definitely not a fan. I mean, these Andy Biggs, we have a list of folks who are like, this is not the way to go about it.
And we know already, too, what happened in Canada during the COVID debacle and what happened to the truckers. And, you know, the popular line is that, oh, Canada has a constitution much like the United States. No, it doesn't. Absolutely, it doesn't, because the rights come from the government in Canada and government can take them away. And I think that is the red flag, is they don't just intend to amend the Constitution, because they can already do that without a constitutional convention. They intend to replace it. And it's been going on for years and years and years. Okay, so let's talk about our battleground states now. We've had a lot of victories. Let's talk about the other states that need victories.
Well, you can actually... I don't have them right offhand, but I know that Wyoming's going to be one that's coming up. And I believe, Idaho is another battleground state. They're really pouring some resources in there. But you could also go to jbs.org under action projects, and you'll see Stop a ConCon. And there we have a map, and we have legislative alerts. And if you are in one of those battleground states, and you're a Bircher, you already know you're there. And so you're probably already involved in this. But if you're watching and, you know, maybe you're just a supporter, or you are a Bircher who's not plugged in and you're wondering, you know, how do I get plugged in? This is a great opportunity to get plugged in. Like I said, it doesn't sound that, you know, super exotic what these folks did, but it's awesome. It really works. Another thing I forgot to mention is that some of our better writers, as far as members, they wrote letters to the editors of their local newspapers, and that again helps as well. There's a lot of things that you can do to help in this fight, because what, like our founder Robert Welch said, our main weapon is education. Education is our total strategy, and truth is our only weapon. So when we help people understand this, their minds open and they make what we think are the right decisions. So we urge Birchers and supporters to go to jbs.org, and under action projects, you'll find Stop a ConCon. And there we have all sorts of resources, where each state is in its process to stop a ConCon. And then you could also, if you aren't already in touch with your local coordinator, you're not sure how to get plugged in, or maybe you're not sure if there's a chapter, you could go take action, connect with a local coordinator and put your zip code, and they'll be in touch with you. And then we'll get you plugged in into this awesome battle.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Paul. We're running out of time today, but I appreciate your time, and we will see everyone back here tomorrow.
Absolutely. Thanks, Rebecca.
Thank you.